Hello, and welcome to the Jambase podcast. Jambase is the media partner for the Osiris Podcast Network, and we want to tell you about a new Osiris podcast, Let Creativity Flow. Sponsored by Splice, this three-episode series explores the evolution of music and technology through the eyes of artists, music industry professionals, entrepreneurs, and journalists. The show explores the fall of industry gatekeepers like record labels, how musicians use technology to create hits, and the future of music creation and collaboration. Let Creativity Flow features interviews with John Barber and Aaron Magner of the Disco Biscuits, Steve Mardosi of Splice, Andy Weissman of Union Square Ventures, and more. Visit osirispod.com/creativity to check out this new show, which premieres on Monday, November 18th. All right, let's get on with our 50th episode of the Jambase podcast. I'm Scott Bernstein, and co-hosting with me is Andy Kahn. Hey, AK.
Hey, Scotty B. Glad to be here.
We begin with our typical The Rundown segment of recent live music news, and then we'll hear my musical mentor's interview with Kelsey Walden. After that is a Quit My Day Job interview featuring Ben Morrison of the Brothers Comatose, who spoke with Jambase's Dave Onigman. We'll hear both of those interviews in a bit, but now let's start The Rundown. We like to say go see live music around here at Jambase, and given the recent amount of tour date announcements, there are plenty of opportunities in the coming weeks and months to do just that. We're going to run down many of the recent tour announcements, starting with perhaps the most noteworthy. The Black Crowes confirming a massive reunion tour next summer. Tell us more about it, AK.
Well, after weeks of rumors and speculation, brothers Chris Robinson and Rich Robinson will reunite the Black Crowes to celebrate the 30th anniversary of their debut album, Shake Your Moneymaker. The Robinsons had unpleasant things to say about each other following the band's breakup in 2015, and a Black Crowes reunion at one point seemed extremely unlikely. But the brothers Robinson seem to have settled their differences, and they appeared together on the Howard Stern show to confirm the reunion and talk about their reconciliation. The 46-date Shake Your Moneymaker 30th anniversary tour, which will feature the band playing the album in its entirety alongside other hits, will take place in amphitheaters and arenas around the United States in June, July, and August 2020. Chris and Rich are the only returning previous members of the Crowes. The brothers filled out the new Black Crowes lineup with guitarist Isaiah Mitchell of Earthless, and former Tedeschi Trucks Band bassist Tim Lefebvre, as well as once and future band members, keyboardist Joe Robineau and drummer Raj Oja. In addition to next summer's tour, the Black Crowes confirmed a pair of intimate concerts in New York City on the day the reunion was revealed, and tonight in Los Angeles. Scotty, you were at the show at the Bowery in New York on Monday night. Tell us a little bit about it.
I will say it was pretty crazy waking up on Monday, having no idea that that night I'd be seeing the Brothers Robinson share the stage for the first time in 6 years. It was a really cool experience. I'm glad I got to do it. And to be honest, I went in with pretty low expectations. I was familiar with the artists in the band. I was happy with the selections they made, with the caveat if they weren't going to pick old Black Crowes members. And it was going to be really interesting to see how it played out. And I'll say from the moment they hit with Twice as Hard, they just were a powerful rock band. And rock was definitely the key word of the night. Chris Robinson said that word at least 10 times. And the Black Crowes even encored with It's Only Rock and Roll by the Rolling Stones, which was the first time they ever played it. Another highlight was Struttin' Blues, which hadn't been played by the Crowes since 1992 and was found on Shake Your Moneymaker, which is the album that they're going to play every night next summer, along with quote unquote all the hits. But as for Monday night at the Bowery Ballroom, which is a venue that holds 575 people and was absolutely packed, there were people everywhere. They played the album as their set, and again, as I mentioned, they encored with It's Only Rock and Roll. I thought the band was fairly tight. There were some moments of looseness, but that's kind of in the ethos of rock and in the ethos of the Black Crowes. And look, I mean, I didn't feel all that great about all the comments the Robinson brothers made over the past few years attacking each other, and then all of a sudden they're coming together without any other Black Crowes alums for this tour. But all the baggage was left at the door, all the talking was over, and it was just time to rock on Monday night. And rock they did. I've seen Chris Robinson dozens of times over the past few decades, and he was in as fine form as I've ever seen him. I've never seen the brothers stand so close to each other, smile at each other, and seem to be genuinely enjoying the experience. They're both over 50 now, and hopefully they will make the most of this opportunity. And it'll be really interesting to see how they fill out the set list, what they consider all the hits as the tour starts. And as we've been discussing, the Black Crowes hit the road next summer. It's a 46-day tour in celebration of the 30th anniversary of Shake Your Moneymaker.
All right, let's look at some other bands besides the Crowes who had new shows hit the Jambase database recently. Be sure to check out Jambase to follow all your favorite bands and stay up to date on all their tour schedules. So we had Widespread Panic confirm a three-night stand next spring at the Chicago Theater. The band will play the historic Windy City venue April 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. Bob Weir and Wolf Brothers confirmed early 2020 tour dates. The band featuring Grateful Dead and Dead & Company guitarist Bob Weir will play 22 shows from late February through March of next year. Ween confirmed a three-night March mitzvah run at Brooklyn Bowl, Las Vegas. The band's visit to Sin City is slated for March 19th, 20th, and 21st. Humphries McGee added a West Coast swing to their 2020 winter tour. The run, which the band has dubbed the Hindsight 2020 Tour, now includes shows in Oregon, Washington, and California. The Tedeschi Trucks Band added 5 dates to their 2020 winter tour. Included are a pair of shows in the Midwest between weekends in Chicago, and a 2-night stand in New Jersey, and a visit to Kentucky. Galactic will be celebrating their 20th anniversary with a 2-month tour this winter. The band will be joined by vocalist Angelica Joseph for the duration of the run, which includes dates with Southern Avenue, Anders Osborne, Jackie Green, and others. Mo will kick off a celebration of their 30th anniversary with a winter tour. The band's first run of 2020 will focus on the West Coast.
Then there's Billy Strings, who detailed a 2020 winter tour. Strings and his band will play a series of 8 headlining dates before opening 2 nights for Humphries McGee and making appearances at Winter Wondergrass in Colorado and California. Yonder Mountain String Band will hit the road with the Traveling Mercuries for a series of 9 early 2020 tour dates in January and February. The newly confirmed Yonder performances come in addition to a previously announced tour that includes co-bills with the infamous String Dusters. Fruition will start 2020 with a 3-week winter tour. The shows come in support of their newly released studio album, Wild as the Night. Then there's the Wood Brothers, who added 18 tour dates scheduled for March and April of 2020 to their touring itinerary. And the tour comes in support of Kingdom in My Mind, a new studio album that's due on January 24th. Turquoise embraced a new palette of colors in anticipation of a new EP and tour. The band, who will forego their signature rainbow stylings for outfits in black, white, gray, and tan, confirmed a winter tour that runs January 15th through February 1st, 2020. Spafford announced an extensive winter tour to start 2020. The Arizona-based quartet's lengthy run currently spans January 15th through April 4th. Then there's Tame Impala, who announced North American tour dates for 2020. Kevin Parker and company will hit the road with support from Clario and MGMT on select dates. Tame Impala is touring around their current album, or their upcoming album, The Slow Rush. Tool will begin 2020 with a 3-week winter tour. The band, who are currently in the middle of a fall tour, released the album Fear Inoculum earlier this year, which was their first album since 2006.
Yeah, I've been hearing great things about that Tool tour. So up next is Bob Dylan, who's going to head to Japan in April of next year. Dylan's visit to the Far East country includes a total of 14 shows. Ringo Starr will bring his current all-star band lineup on the road for a North American tour in spring 2020. The former Beatle and his group's tour spans May 29th to June 28th and includes support from the Avett Brothers at 3 shows and Edgar Winter at 2 others. The Who will be bringing their Move On tour back to the U.S. in spring 2020 for 3 dates. Each of the shows were originally supposed to take place this fall, but were postponed due to vocalist Roger Daltrey's illness. And Elton John added 24 North American dates to the 2020 leg of his Farewell Yellow Brick Road tour. The dates span March through July. John started the tour in 2018 and is expected to conclude his final run in 2021.
I had a chance to see Elton at Madison Square Garden. I believe it was 2018. It was an incredible show. I highly recommend, if you're a fan of his music at all, just go see him once before he calls it a day. But getting back to the tour date announcements, Blackberry Smoke will host the 2020 Brothers and Sisters reunion at the Shed Smokehouse and Juke Joint in Maryville, Tennessee on May 8th and 9th. The intimate performances are the only shows on the band's docket for next year thus far, besides a trip to London opening for the TTB at the SSE Arena on February 1st. The Marcus King Band will also be heading to the UK as part of an extensive 2020 winter tour. Tour starts with a West Coast swing before the band heads to the UK, Europe, Australia, and New Zealand. Pink Talking Fish will begin 2020 with an extensive winter tour of their own. The Fish Pink Floyd Talking Heads Tribute Act confirmed dates on both coasts and a number of cities in between over the course of the first 3 months of 2020.
And then we have Garcia Peoples, who confirmed a series of early 2020 tour dates. The band will perform in the Northeast, Midwest, Colorado, and West Coast to start 2020 in support of their recently released studio album, One Step Behind. Garcia Peoples will also be joined by Chris Forsythe and Riley Walker for 5 shows together, culminating on New Year's Eve 2019. The Circus Comes to Your Town tour will take place in 5 different East Coast cities. Real Estate will hit the road for a 23-date spring tour of the United States in 2020. The band's first run of the year spans April 9th to May 22nd and includes dates on both coasts and a number of cities in between. Additionally, the announcement mentioned the concerts will incorporate new music from a yet-to-be-announced studio album. And Trey Anastasio's favorite King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard will fit in material from all 15 of their albums at a pair of marathon shows in 2020. The band will present the first of the 3-hour marathon sets at the Greek Theater in Berkeley, California on April 18th, and then will repeat the feat at Red Rocks in Morrison, Colorado on May 6th. And so that brings us to the end of the rundown. Like I said before, head to Jambase for complete details on these and many other newly announced tours. And now let's hear Scotty's Musical Mentors interview with Kelsey Walden, whose new album, White Noise, White Lines, is out now on John Prine's Oh Boy Records label.
When the sun sinks down and dreams start to drown and you still don't know who you are. Working the grandpa's like a dog in a pound and you still only get so far. And I'll do it again.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the Jambase podcast. Today I'm here in our New York City headquarters with singer-songwriter Kelsey Walden. How's it going, Kelsey?
It's going great.
Last night you played here in New York City at the Mercury Lounge. How did your show go?
Yes, the show went awesome, actually. We were we were really thrilled with the turnout. Been playing New York City since about 2015. You know, kind of starting back at like, you know, Hill Country Barbecue and stuff like that. Been playing here. So there's been a lot of lonesome nights, and last night was not lonesome.
Oh,
so
that's incredible.
That was, yeah, it feels good to see people there. So, it was great. Everyone seemed to have a good time, and it was fun.
Excellent. Yeah. And Kelsey, you recently released your third studio album, White Noise, White Lines.
Yes.
And that was your first for John Prine's Oh Boy Records label. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about musical mentors in this segment. So let's start with John. And we're recording this on what happens to be his birthday.
Yes.
How did you meet John?
Well, John and I met, so kind of through his wife, Fiona, actually. His amazing wife, Fiona Prine, who also happens to be his manager. So the whole team, the whole Oh Boy team, kind of been knowing them for a little while, at least the past 3 years. You know, they were kind of, felt like they were always in my corner. It was kind of just like this growing relationship. You know, we'd always see each other at shows. I guess, long story short, I released an album independently in 2016 called I've Got Away, and I guess Fiona and John, and actually the whole team, I guess they had heard that actually on Sirius XM Outlaw, they had played some music from the record on there. And I guess they had heard that, and I played this John Prine tribute show in Nashville a couple years ago for Jesse Zazu of Those Darlings. And Fiona was there, and she came up to me and was like, you know, John and I are like big fans of what you do. And I was just like, what? I was like, John Prine knows who I am. I'm like, what's going on? Like, this is crazy, you know, because for me, I mean, John is a huge hero of mine. He has been since I was in high school. I mean, at least 15 or 16 years old. And you know, he's one of my first songwriting heroes, and he still is. Kind of fast forward to when John and I finally were able to play shows together. You know, that kind of caused us to do that. Fiona, you know, made sure to put me on some shows. And then John and I were finally able to meet. We sang together for the first time, actually on one of those Kaomo cruises.
Okay.
First of 2018. So we met there, but then we really got to, sing together, we played some shows in like Knoxville and Huntsville. And like we did some shows where I did like one of my actual, you know, original sets before the show. So, you know, he got to see me play, and we actually got to really bond. And then I don't know, we just started making music together. Rest was history. He started asking about the record, and that was that.
And the record had been recorded for a little bit before John came into the picture. Is that correct?
Yeah, we tracked it in late 2017.
And what were you waiting for? Was it just fortuitous timing that John and Fiona came into the picture, or were you already thinking about releasing it independently?
Actually, no. I had no. I didn't know who was going to put it out. I mean, I'd released two albums independently before that. And I was kind of in a way prepared to do that again. I mean, I didn't want to, and I know I shouldn't, you know, because I certainly didn't have obviously I was at the point in my career where I felt like, you know, okay, something has to happen here. You know, because we had everybody. I mean, we had this whole, you know, amazing, you know, I've been so lucky to have this amazing team, and you know, the missing link was like, oh boy. I mean, we just needed that, you know, the label. So, I mean, I was just super, super patient waiting for the right home for it. So, fortunately, it worked out.
I must have been really excited when the album was finally released.
It was.
About 2 years after it was recorded.
Yeah, but you know what? I mean, most people don't know that unless we tell them. And, you know, when you make a record, I don't think you should try to make it with, like, a time limit in mind, you know? I mean, think about how many records we know and love that have lasted, you know, they're timeless. I mean, like, you should drop a needle on a record and it should sound like it was made yesterday. I mean, that's the energy it should have, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So, I mean, like, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's new to a lot of other people, you know? It's just not new to me.
Absolutely.
I've been listening to it for quite a while, so I'm just happy that like other people are hearing it now, for sure.
And in the conversations that you've had with John, are there any lessons or wisdom that he's imparted on you that you've taken for your career?
I think John, just even watching him, the way he, you know, the way he does his shows, you know, the way he treats his band, the way that just his whole operation works. I think I've taken a lot from that. And also just, you know, just all of his insights on songwriting, you know, he just like even co-writing and stuff like that. You know, I know he never really did that until the past couple years. And, you know, I've never really done that either. And I just really started kind of like opening my mind and heart about that, you know, because John and I are both like, you know, I know we both we write our original stuff and we don't write with a lot of other people, but you know, John was just like, you know, I used to really be afraid to co-write. And he's like, I'm so happy that, you know, that sort of co-writing with other people, you know, later on in my career, because I wouldn't have had all these amazing songs. I mean, there's just like, there's all kinds of stuff. You know, I mean, just even his career in general, I think for me has been very inspirational. I mean, you know, when you can still write relevant pieces of work, you know, inspired album, you know, an inspired album. I mean, at his age, you know, sure. Like Tree of Forgiveness. And, you know, and that was like his most, that was his best-selling record to date. And I can't believe that. I mean, I can believe it because it's amazing. But to me, I'm like, y'all, this is John Prine. Like, he's a legend.
Yeah.
Like, people should have been buying this for, right. They should have been buying this 1971. For years. But I mean, like, you know, it's just really, I think, inspiring to look at a career like that and someone who has kept working. You know, I mean, John plays 2 hours every night. I mean, there's so many young artists that would just be like, I can't play over 45 minutes, you know? And John right. gets up there at his age and just, like, slays it every night.
They don't cover a lot when you look on a map. But I didn't study geography when I was sitting on my mammy's lap. You take a K and an E, an N and a T, a U and a C K Y. That spells Kentucky. And it means paradise.
So all those things have been, you know, careers like his and Guy Clark and like Emmylou Harris and like people that have had careers like that. Like that's what I've like wanted to base my, you know, my path off of, you know. And like Dolly Parton. I mean, people that have just kept putting out work, you know, they've gone through every decade, they've gone through every trend, and their music has remained, you know, like it never goes out of style.
Absolutely. Yeah, like so. You said, drop the needle and it doesn't matter when it was written.
That's
or
what you want.
Recorded. So let's go, speaking about your path, let's go back to the beginning. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about Monkey's Eyebrow, Kentucky, your hometown?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I know it always gets a little snicker, but people usually giggle when they hear that name. But it's completely for real. It's in Ballard County, Kentucky, and that's where we grew up. My dad still lives down there. He has a hunting lodge down there. My whole family's still back home. So, you know, I'm not really that much removed at all. And even where I live now is literally like, it's like an hour and 56 minutes, like, away, like, just across the border in Tennessee, so.
And you're on the side of Nashville that's closer to Western Kentucky.
I am, yeah. I live in Ashland City, Tennessee now. I was in Nashville proper for, like, 8 years. But, yeah, we moved out a little bit now, finally, so I was happy about that.
So you're getting closer to home.
Sure, but also just a little further away. I mean, you know, I love Nashville, but it's changing a lot. You know, there's just a lot of construction and just kind of a lot of noise sometimes. It's just really nice when we get off the road to kind of go back out to the country and where it's quiet. But anyway, yeah. Back home in Ballard County, like in Monkey's Eyebrow, I grew up in literally like backwater country. It's kind of flood country. I grew up in the Ohio River bottoms there. Mm-hmm. So the Ohio River was like right literally like in my backyard, basically, you know, and it would flood all the time. We had to boat into our house a lot growing up. You know, our house was on stilts and, you know, that kind of thing because water gets in there all the time. So, yeah, it's like the Kentucky Swamp. It's a special little region of the Jackson Purchase region is what they call it.
And Kentucky. Multiple generations of your family are from that area?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, my family's always lived there. I mean, since, like, you know, you can trace it back to a long, long time ago. I mean, used to, they all grew up in the river bottoms, but, you know, kind of moved out to higher land. I think everyone started realizing they couldn't farm in the river bottoms, you know, it would flood, you know. You have to keep kind of replanting all your crops if it floods all the time.
Oh, I can imagine.
So, yeah.
And how old were you when you first started playing music?
Started playing music. Well, I guess I started recognizing music probably at a really young age. I know I was at least like 5 or something when I kind of started, you know, playing piano and stuff like that. I had a babysitter that really taught me a lot. She was the music director, like at her little country church and the Mount Pleasant Baptist Church. And she kind of taught me how to read music. And my whole mom's side of the family, they all played though too. My mom and dad didn't, but my granny and my great grandmother, they all played guitar and stuff just for.
For fun?
Yeah, I mean, well, just for as a release. I mean, as like a, I mean, you know, nobody, my great grandparents grew up in the Great Depression. I mean, they were just, you know, picking. I mean, I have a picture of my great grandmother just like with all her thumb picks, like on her old Martin, you know, looking skinny as hell, just like, you know, I mean, it's hard times, you know?
Sure.
But yeah, I started playing music when I was that young. I started playing guitar actually though when I was 12 years old. So I'm 31 now, so it's been a little bit. Started taking guitar lessons around 12. That's when I started writing songs too. So like Bob Dylan and people like that. The first song I ever wrote, I always say this, but it was a total ripoff of All Along the Watchtower by Bob Dylan. Because I was just trying to, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, a lot of my songwriting peers, actually, they all say that. They're like, oh, we all did the same thing. Like, because, you know, when you start trying to kind of put words to music, you're like, well, I mean,
this is what other people are doing.
Yeah, I mean, all the blues guys, you know, I think they did that. I mean, people were just kind of trying to figure out their own thing, you know.
One story that I read, and correct me if I'm wrong, that I thought was so cool, was that for an 8th grade project, you were asked to write a letter to your future self, and you discussed making music a career. Can you talk a little bit about that letter?
Yes, it's funny because I actually didn't even, I don't think I remembered that letter even existed. And I'm trying to think about how we found that, because it was like this thing that I remember our 8th grade teacher made us send to ourselves. It was like made us send it to our future selves, which is kind of a cool idea.
Yeah, definitely.
So I guess when we found it, you know, when you find it later, you're just like, wow, like this is what I wrote to myself. But yeah, there was a whole lot of there was a whole lot of things in there. They were actually really impressive for an 8th grader, I must admit. But
so you still have the letter?
Yeah, I kept it in my drawer, and I think it was just probably in like an old box of old photos or something that we had. But yeah, it just said in there like, you know, I really think I can do this. You know, I think I really want to, you know, have a career in music. Like people think like just because you're from Broward County, you can't do it, but you know that doesn't matter. And all this stuff. So yeah, I think recently NPR actually talked about that, which is funny. I mean, I think that was the first place I ever talked about it, and I don't ever talk about it. So,
right.
Yeah. But yeah, it was that really happened. So that's really interesting that, you know,
I
would be saying that then.
You knew exactly what you wanted to do very early.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, when I was little, I think, you know, my family's always like, oh, you were always like, I want to be a famous country singer. And, you know, of course, whatever that means now. I mean, I don't think I knew then probably the length of, you know, what it was really all about.
Sure.
The work it would actually take. But, you know, and I don't even really know what famous means now. But I obviously had an idea, you know, of like what I wanted to do.
And one thing I love so much about your music is you said country music, but there's so many different influences and genres that you hit within that album.
Sure.
And so what kind of music were you listening to growing up? Who were some of your influences?
Sure. Well, definitely country and bluegrass. I mean, I consider my music in my opinion, it is purely country from the start, but you know, whatever happens within that realm for me is like, it's a whole lot of other things too. And I think that's what country music, you know, always was. I mean, there was always R&B influence, there was always soul influence,
sure.
There was always
gospel,
jazz, gospel. I mean, all that, you know, all that was always, you know, hillbilly music. I mean, you know, it was all there. So to me, that's not weird, you know. It's just kind of whatever comes out. But yeah, I was listening. I mean, country was just a staple. I mean, that was just my grandparents too. I mean, always playing country music in the living room and stuff like that. So that was kind of like, you know, and like going to see Patti Loveless, that was like my first concert ever. She's still one of my favorite singers ever. So, you know, that was all just kind of natural. It's like it was just there, you know. But also, you know, there was like classic rock and like Outlaw Hours with like Hank Jr. in my dad's truck. You know, there was like Lynyrd Skynyrd and, you know, Led Zeppelin. I loved Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd when I was in high school. Discovered John Prine when I was in high school. Started listening to Neil Young. You know, obviously Dylan. I had an older friend give me Rubber Soul by the Beatles when I was 14. And that was kind of like my first, like, that was like the Beatles were like my first, like, band, you know, that I was just, like, obsessed with. And I think a lot of people have that story. But yeah, I mean, I also loved, like, you know, like Janet Jackson and, like, I don't know, just like R&B, like 90s R&B. And soul music too. I mean, Motown. I really loved all kinds of music, I think, in high school. And it's funny though, because I was raised on bluegrass and country, but I think, you know, in my later years in high school, I had some older buddies that, you know, they all played bluegrass. And I think they're the ones that also really started to get me, like, because, you know, it's like you grow up on bluegrass and country, but then, like, they kind of were like, they were into the Grateful Dead and they were into, like, you know, all the deep cut stuff. They kind of started being like, well, you know, here's, you know, all this stuff. So I started discovering all these people from my home state, you know, like Bill Monroe and Keith Whitley and Ricky Skaggs. And, like, you know, I really kind of started digging deeper, you know, like, obviously country music was obvious, but I think, you know, later on in high school, that's when I really started kind of like going back around and getting really, like, really into just, like, you know, going to, like, vinyl stores and, you know, getting deep cuts through of country records. Yeah. And yeah, and just like really discovering stuff.
But good music, so, I mean, is good music regardless of genre.
Oh, no, absolutely.
And were your parents, were they helpful, and were they behind your career path? Are they?
Yes, they were. I think, my mom was always super supportive, and my granny was always very supportive. And my dad was supportive too. I just think it took him a little while to maybe understand, like, what, you know, I mean, but he does really get it though. You know, I mean, he's self-employed with what he does. And, you know, a lot of people told him he couldn't do, you know, like a lot of people were like, you can't be successful, you know, having a hunting business back home and farming and stuff like that. And he has, you know, so he totally understands, like, working for yourself. You know, we always say we don't have a 9-to-5. We just have to strike while the iron's hot.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, but now he's incredibly supportive. You know, I just think it was kind of maybe an odd thing to, like, I think, especially when I first moved to Nashville, I don't think anybody from home, I think everybody was kind of like, well, you know, good luck. Like, just, yeah, good luck. I mean, they were supportive, but, like,
it was on you to do it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But my mother and my grandmother, though, I mean, they were just unwavering.
That's excellent.
Yeah, so,
and you moved to Nashville when you were around 19. Any musicians take you under their wing that you consider mentors from that period when you first moved out to Nashville?
Yes, actually. So maybe not at that point. So when I was 19, I will say, first person musician I ever met in Nashville when I was 19 was Andrew Sovine, who's a great guitar player. He actually recently was playing in Ian No's band. I don't know if you've listened to Ian No. But his granddaddy's Red Sovine, the classic country star. But anyway, we worked at Target together when we were both, like, really young. He was one of the first musicians that actually started inviting me to stuff. Really showed me a lot of things. But fast forward to a couple years later when I moved to Nashville when I was like 23 or so, because I went back home and then I came back to Nashville. So when I was 22, 23 and moved back the second time, I met people like Kenny Vaughn, who's he's in Marty Stewart and the Fabulous Superlatives. He's Patti Loveless's guitar player forever. He's really popular around Nashville. I mean, he's amazing. I mean, he's a B. Bender King, he's awesome. But he was someone that really first started getting me up to sing places and kind of really helped me out with a lot of my first records and stuff like that. Really told me a lot of stuff about, when I was playing shows. He kind of yelled at me and told me that, he didn't really yell at me, but,
Critique,
yeah. That's good. I mean, I took all that stuff from, all those people. I mean, telling my steel player to tune his guitar and, all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
And, because, those guys have a standard, and that's pretty amazing. So, him, and when I started bartending at the Nashville Palace, people like Becky Henson, who was in Porter Wagner's all-girl band for a long, long time, also played with George Jones and so many people. She was in a band that played there all the time, and she really just taught me a lot, I think, about perspective and so many of the musicians I think that played at the Nashville Palace while I bartended there were really big mentors to me. And it's not like they're famous people or anything. They've just played with all the legends and they're still playing every night for 4 hours and not making that much money at doing it. And they just still have the best outlook on life. I just think it just taught me a lot about the reasons why you play music and why you do what you do. And I still consider so many of them family. So I don't know. I just think a lot of them I hold close to being a mentor for me.
And it's almost like that was your school of sorts.
Sure. School, more so than school.
Right.
Yeah. Cause I went to school for a little bit, but I don't think I really learned anything until I was out of it. So sorry, kids.
To each their own. Mm-hmm. And with White Noise, White Lines, you continue the trend of including covers on your album. What influenced you to, put other people's music on your perform other people's music on your albums?
Well, I think first of all, I won't ever put a cover on a record unless we make it our own or unless it has to make sense. I mean, I'm not just the type of person that kind of just throws something on there, and I never want to do something too obvious. It has to be my own thing. It has to be something I feel like I can make my own, and it has to make sense for the record. Everything kind of has intention for me. And so there's a whole lot of reasons I do that.
Reminds me of Willie Nelson.
Yeah, I was about to say, yeah. Willie and Waylon always did that. I mean, Willie, covered a lot of his friends' songs, which is really awesome.
Yeah.
Everybody used to do that kind of thing.
I think it's a good trend. And
sure. I mean, I love my original music. I mean, obviously, it's all about my original music, but I think you're also kind of honoring the music that's come before you and the music that's inspired you. And so, I hope also, covers like my epitaph and stuff like that on their new record. I hope that causes people to hopefully check out Ella Bell Reed and maybe just discover stuff they didn't know existed. And it's fun for me, too, because, I love to sing my own songs, but I love to sing other people's songs.
Sure, absolutely.
For sure. What we do for each other, oh, let us do it today. For we have no pride.
And finally, when it comes to the business side of the music industry, have there been any mentors on that side in terms of running a band or, again, the business side of the music industry?
Yes, there has been. I've been really lucky, first of all, to have a good business influences. You know, I mean, I think there's just a lot of like really you know, like any business side can be kind of dark sometimes and jaded, and I feel like it's hard to kind of find people that you can trust. So I feel like I've been really lucky to have those people in my life that actually did want to help me. You know, people like Tamara Saviano, who was actually my publicist, Maria, who I'm sure you have been in contact yes. with. Me and Maria actually both interned for Tamara Saviano. That's how Maria and I first met. And Maria and I were each other's first clients in Nashville. And so it's pretty amazing, you know, that we're still.
Oh, that's incredible.
Oh, yeah. It's all like everything. It's my family. Whole like operation has been kind of like really homegrown, which is beautiful. You know, it's like people that kind of just stuck with me, you know, and I stuck with them, like even through, you know, all the learning curves and processes that I've been through. But yeah, Tamara Saviano, at the time when I met Tamara, she was Guy Clark's manager. He was a hero of mine, and I got to meet Guy Clark before he passed because of Tamara. She was also Chris Christopherson's manager, and I think still is. She also worked at CMT, and she's done so much stuff. She just wrote the Guy Clark biography. Yeah, Maria and I both learned so much from her. And it's funny because I never thought I would, like, I didn't even want to intern for anybody. Like, I went to school for a little bit, you know, and that just happened by chance too. Like, this fella I knew who was a huge Townes Van Zandt fan in Austin, Texas, Brian Atkinson is his name. He actually, I guess, sent an email, a YouTube video of me doing Rex's Blues by Townes, and sent it to Tamara, who then, this is like not the way this is supposed to work in intern world, sure. right? So like Tamara emails me and is like, hey, I saw this video. Like, would you like to work for me? And I'm just like, well, I never thought about being an intern. Didn't even want to be one, but I was like, I should totally do this because, you know, you like work with my, I don't know. It just seemed, it was just really interesting to me, you know?
Sure.
Like, I was like, wow. So, anyway, I started transcribing the Guy Clark biography, and I'm using finger quotations because I did transcribe it, but I think mostly Tamara just saw something in me perhaps, and mostly I just hung out with Tamara okay. and watched what she did.
Right.
You know, and like she literally just learn. Taught like me, like, I mean, I did help her do things, but she taught me more by like inviting me to dinner with her and different people. And like, you know, I don't know. I realize now that she totally knew what she was doing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
When at the time you yeah. may not have realized the no. grand scheme.
Yeah. And then she was the one that was like, hey, you really need to. When my record, The Goldmine, came out, she was like, I know you don't have any money. I know there's no budget. She was like, but listen, she was like, you should really think about getting, you know, PR for this record. Like, you know, it could really help you just get gigs. Like, she just, you know, she like put all this in front of me so I could just be like, oh, like that's what you do.
Yeah.
I mean, that wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for Tamara. And that's how I met Maria. She was like, you really need to reach out to Maria. Like, she's just starting her new thing. So, well, yeah.
Thanks to Maria Ivy for setting this up. And
yes, I'm sure she's like, why are you talking about me? Yeah. Anyway, so.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Kelsey. And again, White Noise, White Lines is out now on Oh Boy Records. And best of luck as you conclude what's been a big 2019.
Thank you. I feel like we're just getting started. I hope we keep being surprised. So thank you so much. Granddaddy's a local 181. He's working for the union. A wise woman told me memories. You can choose it. This is my DNA. No more.
get such luck. Once it was fresh, now you don't give a fuck. I'm just getting to my good day. Don't want the future.
David Onigman here with the Jam Bass Podcast. I'm here with Ben Morrison, a current Oakland resident, just like Jam Bass is also current Oakland residents here and Bay Area native. Ben, how's it going?
It's great. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Me and Ben were just reminiscing that we had not seen each other since the Brothers Comatose came and participated in the Jam Bass 2015 series Songs of Their Own, where these guys did an incredible rendition of Broke Down Palace that we liked so much that we hung on to it as long as we could, and I think published it as number 47 or 48 of 50 or something like that. And it was a fun day in the office. We were just talking about it. There was another session there with I think the Guitarmageddon guys, and they were running late. And I have this video of the Brothers Comatose out in front of the Jam Bass office rehearsing. Broke down over and over again as they waited for their turn to come in and play. So I'll see if I can dig that up, and we'll try and share that at the same time that we publish this podcast.
Just hanging out among some garbage cans out on
10th and Harrison was not right by the Costco. And Soma Street Food Park. It was if you've been there now, that block looks a lot different. There's like a huge housing complex right across from where Jam Bass used to be. That block doesn't look anything like it. That bus depot is gone. It's all different there.
I used to work at Slim's for a few years back a while ago. Dang, how long ago was that? 10 years ago or something like that? And yeah, it was a lot different back then too.
Yeah, and Slim's was a lot different back then too. Rest in peace, the independent Slim's Presents agency. That's a Golden Voice room now, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy. We didn't get to Slim's as much as we should have when we were right there at Jam Bass, but those shows don't start till 11. So if you're sticking around, it means you're working until 11 and then going to Slim's. But we saw some cool stuff there for sure. Yeah, we missed that office, but we love it over here in the East Bay as well. So we're talking about which segment we're going to do here with Ben, and we're going to go with Quit My Day Job, because Ben's got some good tales about working here in the Bay Area, and then what it was like taking the leap to become a musician full time. But before we get into exactly what it was he was doing first, let's start with when did you first start playing music? At what age and instrument, and when did that first start up?
Oh, man. I think it was probably like 12 or so. My dad had acoustic guitars sitting around the house, and we showed some interest in wanting to play. So I think my grandpa would take my brother and I, my Alex, who plays banjo in the Brothers Comatose. He took us to like the community center where it was like everybody's sitting around in a circle for the group guitar lessons. And I think we learned Proud Mary. It's just like everybody strumming the G chord and in a big circle. And I was like, what the hell is this? I mean, like, this is not what I signed up for. I want to rock, man. So then eventually I got my parents to let me get an electric guitar.
And was this in the North Bay in Petaluma?
Yeah, Petaluma. Born and raised in Petaluma, so pretty close by.
Is your family still there?
Yeah, parents still live up there. Go visit them all the time.
Awesome.
Go see them tomorrow.
So that was about 12. When did you and your brother first start playing in a band together?
It was probably after high school. Actually, we did a talent show for his senior year.
Proud Mary again?
No, I can't even remember what it was. We did some like a Red Hot Chili Pepper song and a couple other tunes. I can't even remember at this point. But I think I played bass and he played guitar. And then our friend Jesse, who's deaf, played the drum.
We have a drummer running audio levels on here too right now. So say hi. Oh, also Jeff. Did you say? Oh, you said Jesse.
Jesse. Yeah.
This is Jeff, but also hopefully not deaf. Say hi, Jeff.
Hello.
Yeah.
Not deaf. Look at that. That was fun. Oh yeah. So then I think shortly after that we kind of just started messing around in the living room. That's how it started. You know, we didn't like intend to start a band right away. Our parents were musicians and they had some music parties a lot because they would invite friends over, and we just decided to like, hey, let's make it a thing where we invite all the musicians that we know to come over on like a Sunday night when nobody was gigging and just kind of like trade songs around and play on each other's tunes and stuff. And it's It's kind of how it started, and eventually somebody left a banjo behind. It was like a friend of my mom's forgot their banjo, and Alex picked it up and kind of started plucking around on it, doing some weird stuff, like playing like blues, rock banjo. Like we were playing like Rolling Stone songs and stuff. And then it kind of just developed from there. And then we're like, oh, let's keep doing this. And we just kind of like booked a couple weird little gigs.
That was probably before it was called The Brothers Comatose, or was that already the name for those first gigs?
I think we just like that popped in our heads early on. And then it started in some weird incarnations with some other friends and that we don't play with anymore. But it was weird. It started as a duo, and then we picked up another person who doesn't play with us anymore to sing. And it's kind of changed over the years for sure.
So after you guys started playing those first couple shows and probably already called Brothers Comatose, did you enter immediately into keeping a day job and having a musician? Living a life as a musician, or?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, like I said, I was working at Slim's.
So was Slim's the first real full-time or steady work that you had?
We had been doing some, it wasn't like a lot of touring at the time. Mm-hmm. I was working at Slim's, and I was working at a vintage costume shop on Hay Street called Aardvark's. And I was doing like that during the day, and then I'd rush off to Slim's at night to do do security there, which is pretty funny because I'm like a pretty skinny guy. and so that took up a bunch of time, but it was really inspiring. Like, I saw all kinds of music, and it was really cool. It was inspiring and sometimes depressing too, to see like these great original bands come through, but like not be, have like super well attended shows, and then there would be like some cover band playing, and there'd be like a line around the block, and you're like, what the hell is wrong with you people? Come on. Like, but you know, people like what they know, I guess.
Remind me again, circa what year? You said about 10 years ago you were working at Slim's.
It was probably actually a little bit, it was probably like 2005 I was working at Slim's, but then, I left Slim's and I started working at a restaurant brewery called Thirsty Bear Brewing Company down in Soma, and that was awesome. It was great. Like I went in and I was like, hey, just so you guys know, like I play in a band and I'm trying to tour and stuff, and they're like, that is totally cool with us. We like that everybody has different things going on in their lives, and that was amazing. Like the fact that I could go on tour for 3 weeks and then come back and then pick up shifts like the next day, that like basically made it so I could be in a band and survive.
Reed Mathis had a very similar story when he did this exact segment. It was one of the very first episodes of the Jam Bass podcast. I think he's talking about a pizza place where he was able to go in and tell them that he also was very passionate about pizza, but that he was going to be disappearing from time to time. For Jacob Fred gigs.
Jazz Odyssey.
Yeah. So it's great when you can find those. So how many years did you keep up Thirsty Bear and sporadic touring?
I think I was probably there for like 4 years. You know, like when I first started that job, we weren't touring a ton, you know?
Mostly regional stuff, like getting...
Regional, California, West Coast. But then eventually, it actually pretty quickly, it picked up to be like 100 plus dates a year. So like maybe a year after I started. And I was probably at Thirsty Bear for 4 or 5 years.
While maintaining a 100-day touring schedule?
Probably for about 3 to 4 of those, yeah.
Man.
Yeah. It was crazy. And that's just shows, too, like not including travel days and things like that. And eventually, it just... It's not that I didn't like the job or that I wanted to like, I was like waiting to leave that job because I really liked it. I liked the people that ran it and worked there. And it was just kind of like a fun gig too, you know, but, eventually it just got so crazy that, you know, we were kind of like managing ourselves and, I was just putting in a lot of work and just didn't have the time anymore to go work at the serving job. So, eventually, I was just like, I kind of just have to focus on the music and doing all that.
And that was about how many years ago now?
Seven, six or seven. I can't remember anymore.
We didn't know we were going to be talking about this until you walked in here. It's fine. Yeah. You don't need to know the exact dates.
Something around six, maybe about 6 years ago or something like that.
Did you feel hesitation about like taking that leap when you?
No.
I mean, you were ready to do it.
I mean, like I said, I love the job and I love the people, but it was also like a dream to just do music.
Yeah.
Since I was a young teenager.
And did you guys ramp up touring even more once you sort of freed up your schedule?
We haven't really. We've gotten to like the 140 shows in
a
year. Yeah, it's a lot. But like it kind of averaged around 120, so it was like fluctuated a little bit.
Yeah,
but,
well, it could be like a month more touring on the road once you sort of freed up that time.
Yeah.
And right now you are also balancing the Brothers Comatose and solo gigs.
Yeah.
The Brothers Comatose were supposed to take some time off, but you guys did not actually take that much time off, did you?
less than I expected. I mean,
what was the catalyst? Did you guys just miss it too much, or a couple gigs come up? What brought you guys back quicker than you thought you were gonna take time off the road?
Well, the reason that we stopped was two guys left the band.
Okay.
Gio, the bass player, and Ryan, the mandolin player, both left the band like basically at the same time. And so my brother and Phil, the fiddle player, and myself, we're just like, what do we do? Do we like chill for a little bit before we start looking for people? Because, finding the right people to play with is a difficult thing, because not only do you have to like gel musically, but like you really have to be like really good buds or get along super well in the van. I mean that's probably even more important than like the music stuff can come later. If you get along with somebody really well in the van, like that's number one, because if you don't, then
you have to spend 140 days playing music and 170 days traveling around to the shows. And
so basically we kind of decided when the guys left the band, we're like, all right, let's take a little bit of a breather and kind of focus on our own things for a minute, and just we've been touring a lot, so it was nice just to be at home with our partners and families and stuff. Our fiddle player had two kids, and so I thought that would be a great opportunity for me to record a solo album, and
which is sitting right here.
Yeah,
we have old technology, which is printed on a CD, which I guess is old technology.
It is. Yeah, who listens to those things anymore? So I was like, guys, just I'm gonna work on a solo album while we take a break, and they're like, cool, no problem. And so I did, and then I as I was working on, I was recording in chunks, we kind of just found some band members for the Brothers Comatose by accident. It just kind of like happened, and then so things got ramped up a little bit sooner than we had expected. So now I'm like trying to finish my
solo. I was looking at your itinerary for September, and it's basically half Brothers Comatose and half solo gigs.
It's crazy. Yeah, it's pretty chaotic.
Yes, it's lucky you have a former jam bassist, Casey Schaefer, to help you manage of these things. What's up, Casey? Well, I'm not going to tell you I say this. We'll see if you actually listen to this. So send me a text when you hear this.
And I'm getting married in like 2.5 weeks. So I'm like trying to plan a wedding at the same time while going on tour with two bands, and it's freaking insane.
You seem to be handling it, like, sort of since you walked in here. You seem like you got it under control.
Something like that.
Where are you getting married?
Up in Santa Rosa.
Nice.
Yeah.
What's the live music programming for
a
Morrison wedding?
A band called the Coffis Brothers.
Oh, I've been to a wedding where they've played, actually.
No way.
Yeah, my friend Molly got married in Santa Cruz, and the Coffis Brothers played their wedding.
They're awesome. They're good buddies. And actually, Jamie plays keys on this solo album, and we co-wrote a song for it, too.
Nice. Yeah. And your partner-to-be is also a musician, right?
Yeah, Erica of the T-Sisters.
Who also has come in and recorded with Jam Bass. If you're seeing a theme, we like to bring in all these Bay Area people to to come in and record stuff with us.
That's awesome. As
best we can. Well, before we wrap up here, we've talked a little bit about it, but tell me about, well, we're going to talk about your solo record. How many records did Brothers Comatose record before you did this first solo on yourself?
Four full-length albums, and then we did like a couple, three cover EPs, I think. For a few years in a row, we started doing these cover EPs where every Halloween we would like.
I know you guys have a cover of Valerie that is very well played on things. Is that on one of those, or is that no, one, that's, that, on, that's on an LP?
That's on an album. Yeah. And then, but yeah, we kind of just like decided to pick a style of music. Like we'll do like the punk one or the metal one, metal EP, and then we'll do a few of our songs in the style of those things.
That's going around. I was just do you guys have some kind of connection to Goodnight Texas, right? Aren't all of you guys somehow all related? They just did a metal thing as well. Bad Night Texas. It was so cool.
Oh my God, I love that. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember at the time I was trying to figure out an org chart to figure out who shared band members and who sometimes played with whom. It was a confusing one to figure out. But I know you guys are somehow adjacent, you and Goodnight Texas. Their drummer
is now playing bass in the Brothers Comatose. And played bass all over this record.
All right. So yeah, you've talked about a couple of people that have played on it. Tell me about the record and specifically what it was like sort of being the name on it rather than it being sort of like a more democratic way of going about recording a record. How did it go for you recording your first solo record?
It was so fun. It's kind of hard to describe, you know, like, I guess it's kind of like a relationship thing. You know, you've been in a relationship for a long time and then all of a sudden you meet somebody or like that ends for whatever reason. Then you like go and meet somebody else and it's like a honeymoon period or whatever, like fresh and exciting again. Like it was cool to play with different people and bounce ideas off those people and to play with drums. Like that's just something because, you know, Brothers Comatose is an all string band. And so you're kind of limited by those instruments and what you can do with them. But like it was super freeing to be able to bring in songs that wouldn't quite work in that format and to do it with keys and electric guitar and bass and drums and background vocalists. It was amazing. It was really, really fun. And we did it locally. We recorded at Tiny Telephone.
Oh, that place is awesome.
Yeah, to like 2-inch tape, you know, old school. It was, and luckily everybody that was playing on it is a total badass. So it was like, you can actually like record to 2-inch tape. You don't have to go through and edit a bunch of stuff, you know, like it just, everybody was that good. So
all those years playing without a drummer, do you think it was maybe because the first one you played with was deaf?
That is funny. Yeah. Maybe that factored into it.
All right. Well, Ben, thanks for coming by and thanks for chatting with us. If you're looking to see Ben on the road, you can come visit his page on Jambase. We'll list both his Comatose gigs and his solo gigs right on one profile on Ben Morrison page on Jambase. And you can follow him all the other usual spots on the web, and if I know him, he'll be playing a lot of dates around you soon.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
I hope you're not sorry that you ever came. I hope you're not sorry that you ever came. I hope you're not sorry.
That's all for episode 50 of the Jambase podcast.
Whether this is your first time listening, or if you've been with us since episode one, we want to send our sincere thanks for sharing your time and your ears with us. Jambase is the media partner for the Osiris Podcast Network. Be sure to check out the new podcast, Let Creativity Flow, when it premieres on Monday, November 18th. Visit osirispod.com/creativity to check out this new show, and visit Jambase to listen to all of the Osiris Network podcasts. We want to thank Kelsey for chatting with us. You can find her new album, White Noise, White Lines, wherever good music is sold. Thanks also to Ben for taking the time to meet with us. Grab his solo album, Old Technology, at those same good music retailers. Thanks to Telefunken for the microphones and to Jake Alexander for putting this episode together. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to the Jambase podcast. If you like what you hear, give us 5 stars, leave a review, tell your friends. We'll be back soon. In the meantime, take care of each other and go see live music.